It's such an early product in such an early space that at this moment in time, I think anyone who's trying to price this, they really are just trying to see where the market's at.
All that and more on today's Mixture of Experts. I'm Tim Huang, and welcome to Mixture of Experts. Each week, MOE brings together a panel of the sharpest minds in technology to distill down what's important in the latest news in artificial intelligence. Joining us today are three incredible panelists, so a very warm welcome to Ash Minhas, lead AI advocate, Ambi Ganesan, a partner AI and analytics, and Sandy Besson, AI research engineer. Welcome to you all. Really exciting and interesting episode today. We're going to cover all sorts of different aspects of what's been happening in the news. First, we're going to talk a little bit about 1X Neo, which is a newly announced humanoid robot and the sort of Wall Street Journal review of it. We'll talk a little bit about an interesting challenge to OpenAI's Sora 2 from Japanese copyright holders. And then finally, we'll talk about a big partnership between AWS and OpenAI. But first, we've got Eily with the news.
Hey, everyone. I'm Eily McConnon, a tech news writer for IBM Think. I'm here with a few AI headlines you might have missed this week. AI giant Perplexity will pay $400 million to integrate its AI-powered search engine directly into the Snapchat app, so the social media platform can be used for AI search in addition to sending snaps, those images and messages that disappear. Two trends collide. Crypto platform Coinbase is giving AI agents their own crypto wallets to buy things on behalf of customers instead of simply recommending purchases. Instacart has launched a suite of AI enterprise tools for grocery stores, so retailers have a real-time view of what's on their shelves at any moment. This also means that shoppers will have an AI assistant for personalized meal planning and budgeting. Google is launching AI chips into space on solar-powered satellites to test out solar-powered AI, a project aptly called Suncatcher. Want to dive deeper into some of these topics? Subscribe to the Think newsletter, linked in the show notes. And now, back to the episode.
The first thing I want to start with is kind of this video that got passed around wildly on social media this week that was covering the 1X Neo. Now, longtime listeners to the show will remember that we actually talked about Neo when it was first announced, but it is finally open for sales. You can go and buy it. It's being offered as a $500 a month subscription or a $20,000 early access fee. And what 1X Neo is it's a humanoid robot. The idea is it's literally a life-size sort of mannequin-style robot, which will be in your home and help out with home tasks. And so I guess, Ash, maybe I'll kick it over to you first. Does this have legs? Are, you know, in 2028, are we going to all have sort of a humanoid robot in our home? Or how, do you think this is going to end up being much more of like a sort of specific use case as we see this company launch its first products?
I think that they did a really, really good job of their video introducing their product to the world. The Wall Street Journal video showed huge discrepancies in terms of what its capabilities are today versus, you know, what they showed as like the art of the possible. I think that there's probably more than a year's worth of development work to go into putting something like that in my home where I'm going to trust it with my glasses and my kitchen.
And all those my fragile, cutlery. Breakable yeah. things in your kitchen.
Yeah, exactly. I think that the fact that during the Wall Street Journal interview, the founder was very open about the fact that there's teleoperation happening is an eye-opener, I think, for us as a society to realize that a lot of these robotics that are having to deal with very, very complex, ambiguous environments, we're just not there yet with the AI technology to power them to do that job accurately. And I do think that there's probably quite a number of years to go yet.
Yeah, for sure. And Sandy, I'm wondering if you can give us kind of like maybe an intuition for why it is so difficult, right? Like we've seen these huge explosions in AI capabilities. But as yet, right, like I think the Wall Street Journal review, which was widely passed around, you know, the robot is depicted trying to basically like open and close a dishwasher door.
The dishwasher. And it's
Yeah. And it takes like minutes to do. What's so difficult about this task from an AI standpoint?
If we look at where we've seen robotics prosper, it's in settings where the job is quite monotonous, right? It's quite routine. Like in Amazon factories is like famous for having largely robotics and roboticized? Is that a word? Maybe it will become a word. but it's famous for having that, right? But when you're taking more general tasks, everyone's home is unique. Not just has a different layout like your robo vacuum, right? But has different handles and different buttons and different makes of washing machines and gas range stoves versus electric stoves and things like that, right? There's so much variance that just like Waymo experienced with driverless cars, which are still only allowed to go up to 25 miles an hour, and that's just starting to change. Right? They're going through this evolution where they're going to need to collect a lot of training data. And that kind of poses the question of like, how are they going to do that? And do people want that in their homes for them? Like, he had this really interesting construct of Big Sister in the Wall Street Journal view that I thought was a cool way to look at it, right? It's like, okay, we have this negative concept of Big Brother, but is Big Sister an okay concept because it's going to help you long term?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Waymo comparison is a really good one. And Ambi, I want to get your thoughts on this. Is like, I mean, Waymo works now. I mean, if you've been in San Francisco recently, you can call a robot car. It rolls up, you can jump in it. And I think for me, like what made me very confident about the future of it is that like after the second or third ride, it's like completely boring. Like you don't even think about it at all. But that took a really long time. And I guess the question for you is if you think that like, you know, we're going to see a different, similar timeline on this kind of thing, right? Where I think Google's been talking about autonomous vehicles for, I don't know, over a decade. I actually don't know when they started talking about it. You know, do you think there's a similar timeline here before we have really kind of like fully automated kind of home robots?
Yeah, and that's the way that I feel about the Waymos as well. I've taken a bunch of those. And, you know, I always say that the most surprising thing about the Waymos is that it's so unsurprising, right? Like it's so normal that you just don't feel anything about it out of the ordinary, right? Like we've got a ways to go before we get to that stage on home robotics. And, you know, for me personally, and I think a lot of us would feel this way as well. Like I, you know, growing up, I was a huge Isaac Asimov fan. And, you know, I always think about the three laws of robotics, right? You know, don't do any harm, or through inaction, don't cause any harm, right? Always, you know, safeguard humanity. Don't do any stuff that, you know, that's going to put yourself in danger, things of that nature, right? I think there are ways to go before we encapsulate all of those and then make home robotics approach that space, right? So to Sandy's point, Waymo and, you know, the autonomous vehicles work to some extent because the space, the search space is a little bit structured, right? Like you're always going to have street signs, like you're always going to have roads marked with lanes, right? There are a bunch of these factors that are structured. Whereas when it comes to home robotics, right, the search space is so unstructured and vast and infinite. It's going to take some time. I think there are some tantalizing, clues and aspects that I think we are saying, hey, maybe we can use world models to simulate and synthesize data, and then maybe we'll do. But there's a bunch of maybes here that we got to figure out. So there's, you know, if you look at it from multiple factors, right? Are you going to get enough data to do the training? Are you going to have enough? You know, just think about all the compute capacity that, you know, every time we hop on this podcast, we complain about, oh, you know, the compute capacity getting constrained, infrastructure becoming the moat, right? Now, just think about all the infrastructure that you'll need to run these robots at scale, right? There's so much that's pending to be built out from that infrastructure layer perspective. And then the third piece is, you know, like I mentioned, all the safety aspects. Right? Whether you subscribe to the three laws of robotics or some fashion of it, you know, we'll have to come and codify and say, okay, you know, here's how we need to regulate and leverage home robotics, right? And there is a lot to be figured out there. So yeah, this is going to be a multi-year journey. It's not a, you know, one and done deal in a couple of years, honestly.
One thing I was thinking of when I watched the Wall Street Journal video was, I was thinking, I wonder if the folks of Neo have thought, maybe we should just send the robots to IKEA stores and just get them to walk around the whole IKEA store for a while and just get them to train. Like, they could just walk around, opening and closing all the drawers and sitting on the furniture and doing all that stuff. And then probably collect a mountain of training data doing that.
And then they come to your house, right, which doesn't have IKEA, and then they'll fail.
Well, and Ash, if I could stay with you, I do want to talk a little bit about the data aspects of this, right? Because I think, as you mentioned, right, like it came out in the review that a lot of it is still teleoperated. And, you know, ultimately, I think the teleoperation is to collect data on how you might ultimately kind of navigate these complex spaces. I mean, I think one of the things I hear from Ambi's comments is basically that, like, you know, if anything, homes are even more complex than trying to navigate the road. I guess, Ash, with that all in mind, like, why are they pricing it so expensively, right? Like, $500 a month is like, that's like 2.5 ChatGPT Pro subscriptions, right? And if you want to buy like the main one, it's like $20,000 for early access. But the data is so valuable. Why aren't they just making this product like $20 a month, right? Because like the data is really what they need in order to get this thing to work.
I really have no idea how the financing has worked to get the startup to where it is today, to know what they're looking at achieving by charging this price. I think that it's such an early product in such an early space that at this moment in time, I think anyone who's trying to price this, they really are just trying to see where the market's at. And I think they probably looked at this and thought, what does a housekeeper cost? What's that working out to for a household every month? And they're looking at what's that point at which, you know, this becomes more cost effective than a housekeeper. And they're kind of trying to anchor on the price and they'll get the product there. I do think that there probably will be some volatility in that business model and pricing as this actually matures over the coming years. But you know, as I said, it's so nascent right now. You're not going to have one of these in your home.
I was just going to say, I think they're constrained by their own constraints, right? It's like you said, the teleoperation, they have to have people that are, right now you're scheduling this on an app, right? So if they make it so widely available, now they have to get hundreds of teleoperators to do these things, right? And train those people and scale it up. So for an early access product, I think it makes perfect sense, even if it means that it takes longer for the product to improve, that they're doing so in like a really scoped way that they can control.
One interesting thing that I noticed was that they were already anchored on the fact that people should have this expectation that you're going to have a companion application on your phone or something, and you have to schedule when the robot's going to operate. And I thought that was kind of like sort of anticlimactic, as it were. Why would you have a robot in your house that you've got to schedule to do something, you know? And it comes down to that same constraint that you implied, Sandy, right? They've got to hire people to teleoperate these things, right? And they need shifts, I guess. And there's a whole labor model
really
there.
A virtual housekeeper right now. That's kind of what it is. You're outsourcing the body of a housekeeper, but you have someone behind the scenes that's still doing the work for right now. But that will change overall. And to be honest, if I don't have to fold my clothes and wash them and put them away in 2 years' time, I would be happy to give it access to the viewings of my wardrobe.
Well, we'll have to have you back on in 24 months. That's a good prediction.
I mean, I think a lot of this is like, we probably shouldn't worry too much about the price piece here. A lot of this, I think, is also to capture the mindshare, right? I mean, there's a reason now we're talking about all of this and they're capturing the mindshare, right? Like, I think robotics has, like, Optimus has been, you know, edging at the top of the mindshare. Figure has been pushing it, right? Yes, they're operating in the industrial setting. The home robotic space was a little bit open. I think, you know, this has gotten a lot of us talking about it and capturing mindshare, right? Pricing, to Ash's point, I think is a little bit of a dart on the board right now. No one really knows. Yes, granted, you know, there is a lot of sophisticated instrumentation that's needed to make something of this nature work, right? So it's not just purely, hey, you know, I'm collecting data and then I'm training data and I'm just inferencing it somewhere. There is a lot of physical, you know, equipment that's needed in order to make this work, right? Like you'll have sophisticated actuators and gears doing this in precise fashion. So there is, I get the cost of operations and cost of manufacturing probably is a factor in there. But bottom line, right, it is a little bit of a dart in the board. This whole, I think, push and declaration is a little bit to capture the mindshare and then declare to the world that, okay, we are taking a step forward and we are going to go proceed forward.
I'm going to move us on to our next topic. So super interesting story came out of Japan earlier a week ago. There's an industry organization in Japan called the Content Overseas Distribution Association, or CODA for short. It's an anti-piracy organization that represents basically Japanese IP holders. So Bandai Namco, Studio Ghibli, like a lot of your kind of favorite brands out of Japan are kind of represented by this organization. And what's interesting is that they sent a letter to OpenAI expressing concern about essentially the use of their intellectual property in Sora 2 and the generation of videos that kind of like implicitly sort of like rely on that IP. And I think it was such an interesting case. And I guess, Sandy, like, I guess the question for you is, you know, how do you think OpenAI should kind of navigate these types of discussions, right? It's like a really hard and tricky thing about how, you know, the sort of rights of these rights holders should be taken accounted for, but also like to give the freedom to kind of innovate on the technology. And I think there's just like a really interesting set of questions there.
Totally. And the more I was thinking about it, the more I was like, oh my God, this is a large task. Like, there's a few ways if I was OpenAI, I would think about it. One is, do we actually have to alter, and I'm sure they're already thinking about this one, do we have to actually alter our pipeline of how we tag and add metadata to our training data to be able to flag exactly where everything is coming from? And to some extent, they might do this, but they might not have IP owners on there or certain things like that. And then do I have to potentially, in order to, in some ways, make this go away, potentially do some sort of revenue share? Like, in the end of the day, that's what IP and royalties are about, right? They're about sharing revenue. So is it possible that if I say, like, hey, make me a cartoon version in the style of Studio Ghibli, that's tagged somewhere if it's using Studio Ghibli, and there's some sort of revenue share there? That's one way, if I were OpenAI, I would be thinking about it to kind of escape all of these large lawsuits. But I think that also opens up the other end of the side where it's like, okay, well, who's going to actually collect all this information? Is there opportunity for a market share, a marketplace out there that essentially has the rights of people that say, yes, I allow you to use this data, or you are not allowed to use this data? But the further I kept thinking about that, the more, and I'm a little bit on a monologue here, but the further I kept thinking about that, the more I realized, is this just more argument to move into synthetic data? And then what happens to IP and ownership if it's almost like inception, right? Like IP ownership inception, where is it still owned by that person if it's influenced because it's created synthetically via that? And so you kind of move into this like ownership inception, right? So I truthfully, I don't know where this is going to end up.
Ambi, what do you think about all of this stuff? I think, yeah, where I was going maybe with this discussion that I was interested in was what Sandy was mentioning, is it feels like it's really hard to figure out how you would set up kind of like like some kind of payments infrastructure here. And so is one possibility that a lot of these companies just start investing a lot more in synthetic data, right? Like kind of the era of like, we need to scoop up all this data to train our models is going to give way to, well, just we're going to try to do synthetic as much as possible.
I don't think, you know, anyone has solved this, right? No one really has a clear understanding or has a clear solution to any of this at this point in time. It's really, really murky waters. I'm going to put a little bit of an enterprise lens on it, because I talk to clients and I deal with enterprises on a day-to-day basis. And, you know, when I look at it from their perspective, you can't afford to have any of these being transmitted back to enterprises, right? And there are two forks in the road that I'm seeing. There's one set of model providers very early on, they always said, you know, I'm just going to go for completely copyrighted data. I'm not going to go and scrape anything. And I'm going to go only use that. And that becomes a safe approach and a safe path for enterprises to consume, right? And then there is the other fork, which is, you know, the likes of Gemini and OpenAI have clearly, you know, it's very consumer facing, and therefore, you know, a lot of, you know, the imitation aspects that creep in here. But, you know, for enterprises, outside of a text modality, if you're getting into image or video modality, right, something like this is still a landmine that they wouldn't want to touch on, right? So that piece has to be solved. I don't think there is a clear answer to it yet. Maybe synthetic data, but even there, right, like who draws the boundary? Like at what point do you say, this looks like a Studio Ghibli style. No, this doesn't look like a Studio Ghibli style. There is no quantitative way for you to actually go and, you know, delineate that, right? So it's a little bit of a fuzzy aspect over there. No hard and clear answers over there, right? I think the safest approach some of the model providers, you know, like Adobe have taken is saying, I'm not even going to touch any of that. Before all of this thing gets sorted out, I'm just going to go train on just purely copyrighted data, and then I'll deal with that for the time being. So, you know, it's still those two forks in the road that hasn't seen, you know, fundamentally changed over the last year or year and a half, right? I think there is an opportunity to be made, like, you know, like Sandy is saying, if the model providers are okay with some of these rev share agreements, and, you know, I think there could be an enterprising layer that creeps up between the artists and the model providers. It may not even be the model providers themselves. There may be a third party that says, okay, you know what, I'm going to help the artists form a consortium or form a network, and then I will, you know, help transact all of these between the model providers and the artists. So I think there's some new spaces to be covered here.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ash, maybe I'll give you the last word on this. I mean, I think part of the big question is, yeah, like, I think it's like part of what's difficult about this discussion is like to what Sandy's saying, like, in principle, it makes a lot of sense, right? Like you contribute some data and you should be compensated for the use of it. In practice, it's really, really complicated. And I think one of the questions is like how we say something is so close enough in style that you deserve to have some kind of compensation. Like, do you think at that point we're going to just have to draw an arbitrary line? It'll be like, oh, we're going to calculate a difference vector between this video and this video. And if you are within this threshold, then you have to pay. And if you're outside this threshold, then you don't have to pay. Like, some of this might just ultimately be maybe arbitrarily resolved. Like, do you think that's where we land with some of this?
I don't know if it is somewhere where we're going to arbitrarily land. I think that there's too much at play here, both commercially as well as culturally, for there to be a place that either the technology companies or the people who own the rights to a lot of this art are going to let that happen. I think that ultimately, at this moment in time, we're still in a very nascent space, right? I remember when Stable Diffusion came out in the first instance, and, you know, as background, I'm a photographer, okay? And I've always, like, over the last sort of 10 years or so, shared very few pieces of my photography on the social networks because I'm like, hey, that I'm transferring my rights away from my work. And so we've now got to this place now where these generative models, we need them to be good to be able to get value from them. But if you need them to be good, you need them to be able to respond accurately to what people are asking for, right? And, you know, as Ambi already touched on, at what point does that become censorship, right? You know, like at what point when someone's prompting the model and saying, hey, I want you to make me a picture of this, you know, at what point, like, if we just keep on putting in sort of protections there at the prompt level to go, hey, you can't prompt for this, you can't prompt for this, you can't prompt for this. What I think about is who's making those decisions, right? And I guess at this moment in time, in this huge AI race that we've got going on, no one really wants to do that too much because it makes their model less helpful. And so I think that this won't be arbitrary. I think that this is just a lot of like back and forth that's going on between so many different stakeholders right now. And we really need some sort of like real frameworks in place, you know, ideally from like a from a government and a societal level to make some decisions here as to what is and isn't allowed. And people should abide by that.
I'd like to just add one little point is something that Ash and Ambi both touched on is that I think a lot of us look at it from the output perspective, like the user perspective, like what are we prompting for? What does the model output show? But in reality, there's an entire field called model interpretability, right? Where they're trying to understand behind the scenes the reasoning of the model. And they have like the famous example, I think, is talking about what is the capital of France, right? And they're seeing the nodes light up throughout the model, right? And so are we going to accelerate our interpretability of the reasoning of the models to understand what's actually being used to produce this output? Or are we going to assess it from the perspective of the output? And I think right now we don't have a choice but to assess it from the output because we don't understand the innards, right? But as we start to understand the innards, there's going to be even more of a case for these other companies to say, hey, you're using my stuff because some node got, you know, activated somewhere deep in the neural network. And then it will become even more gray.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I think in some way, almost like it's like the illusion of clarity is like once we start digging, it'll be like, okay, well, presumably some people will come up with prompts that can get very similar styles that don't activate certain kinds of neurons. And that ends up becoming a new game, right? Once even as the field kind of improves. So. All right, I'm going to move us on to our last topic of the day. Super interesting story, particularly on the backdrop of the last MOE that we recorded for Halloween last week. There's basically news that OpenAI has announced a new partnership with AWS. I will always kind of like quote the numbers here because they continue to be mind-blowing to me. So OpenAI is doing a deal with AWS that represents a $38 billion commitment. Expanding its compute capacity and basically working with AWS to expand on its infrastructure. This is an interesting one. Amazon, of course, has been touting its Trainium, its specific chip. But this one seems very much still focused on NVIDIA GPUs, at least from the blog post. And I guess maybe, Ambi, I'll throw it over to you first. It seems like one of the things we keep talking about on MOE is how you're starting to see like these like alliances form, where you're like, okay, you've got Anthropic and they're getting close with GCP, but they're also a little bit close with AWS. And then, you know, of course, OpenAI is very close with Azure and Microsoft, and now they're also getting close with AWS. I think the most interesting thing, and maybe a good place to start, is it seems like a lot of these companies are going multi-cloud ultimately, which seems like, I guess, if you want to give us an intuition for why they're doing that, because my sense of it is that that actually adds quite a lot of complexity.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think alliances is the right word. It always reminds me of like Game of Thrones, and it's so confusing who's alliance.
Who's in a royal marriage with who?
Exactly,
you know,
right? It's so exciting, right? A new episode comes out and new things.
It's the nerdiest possible Game of Thrones you could imagine.
But yeah, I mean, the $38 billion, if you think about the $1 trillion supposed at IPO, I mean, this is like a drop in the bucket, right? So, but, you know, leaving that aside, right? I mean, it sort of makes sense, right? You want to diversify. You don't want to put all eggs in one basket. So, yeah, I mean, you have to diversify. Like we were talking about in a previous episode, right? The moat is shifting from pure model layer into the infrastructure layer and some of the depths of the infrastructure layer, right? So knowing that, I think it makes sense to ensure that you don't put all your eggs in one basket and then just go with one infrastructure provider, and therefore you diversify into AWS. What I found surprising was, you know, there wasn't a reciprocal arrangement for AWS to host the, you know, the proprietary models from OpenAI and then expose them, right? That is still an exclusive arrangement between OpenAI and Azure. So, you know, it's a little bit of a one-way, imbalanced relationship, I would say. what would have made it more interesting was, you know, the models are also getting hosted on multiple different environments, and it becomes truly, you know, diversified, and you're getting to, you know, when I talk to enterprises, they've all moved on to just going with one model to having a mixture of, or a choice of picking their own models and cloud providers, right? Just like we went with the hybrid cloud approach, that it's we are fully seeing the hybrid model approach. So I would have liked to see some of that manifest here. But yeah, bottom line, I think this is purely hedging your bets and making sure that you're not getting stuck in the infrastructure mode and getting caught there, right? That's the simple way to look at it.
Sandy, one interesting aspect of this is, in contrast to the Anthropic deal, which very much kind of touted, like, we're working with TPUs. I think the language is like, we will use up to 1 million TPUs or some crazy number like that. This one really does still seem focused on NVIDIA GPUs. And I guess maybe it seems like one part of this deal is that OpenAI is not really, maybe it's changing and diversifying its infrastructure providers, but at the end of the day, the chips are still the same.
That was 100% what I was going to hit on, is that they've seemed to have chosen their hardware provider. They can diversify in their cloud infrastructure. They can diversify in how they offer it to end users. But they seem to have clearly chosen their hardware providers. And the reason for that is not all chips are created equal, number one. And two is models are optimized specifically for the hardware that they run on. So clearly, OpenAI has done a lot of work in optimizing their models to run most efficiently on these NVIDIA chips. Right. And so to make that switch is no easy feat. That's like teams and many hours and many weeks and potentially months of switching cost. And is it worth that if AWS also offers the thing that they're already optimized on?
It's a really hard call. And I guess part of it is just like, are you willing? It's almost like how powerful CUDA is at like this gravitational well, where it's like really hard to kind of optimize outside of it. I guess, Ash, is this ultimately like, how much of a difference do you think this makes, like, going forwards? Like, this is sort of the direction you'd expect these companies to be moving in? Or, you know, how much of this, like, I think a little bit about how, like, Netflix used to run a lot of its infrastructure on AWS. And, you know, it seems possible to me that over time, like, OpenAI could become, like, much more of an AWS provider or a consumer. You know, do you, I guess, in the battle of the clouds, do you feel like one has an advantage over the other?
I don't know whether I would look at it with that lens of it being a battle of the clouds. The way I'm looking at it is, at a macro level, they're doing so much stuff with AI that they need all the GPUs that they can get their hands on. Okay, and what I found really, really interesting in this specific announcement that they made was they actually called out somewhere in it to say that they are going to use this to rapidly scale agentic workloads. And so I'm wondering, what are these agents doing? Right? Okay. And I don't think it's sort of a battle of the clouds per se, Tim, but more a case of they're using different infrastructure providers for doing different types of work. Right. And I mean, I honestly don't know what those agentic workloads are doing. But I think it just comes down to there's not enough GPUs available. They need to get something done. They're a rapidly scaling company. AWS has got loads of GPUs that they're willing to sell them. And they're like, great, we can take this portion of work that we need to do and we can just go scale it over there quickly.
Right. It's like almost like any GPU in a storm was just like, whatever is available, we'll take it.
If I can add to what Ash said, I think you've hit the nail on the head in terms of it's for a different point. I don't think they're doing training on these GPUs. I think they're doing inference. And that means that they're moving more into their OpenAI for business play with it. Because what do businesses use? They use cloud, right? And so as they scale more into their enterprise piece, if I had to take an educated guess, I would guess that they're using this compute power more for building agentic workloads with their clients. And that's where they're going to use that inference for.
Yeah, TBD. I have a slightly different take on that. Like I said, right? Again, they haven't given us a lot of details. So yes, enterprises, you know, will use Azure, will use AWS, all of that. But unless, you know, OpenAI is exposing them on the AWS environment, then it's not going to be consumable. So the big question is, okay, are you just using it to run your workloads, or are you going to actually offer a marketplace, or are you going to, you know, offer a way to consume it on AWS? If it is the latter, then yeah, I mean, that's fantastic, right? I mean, that would be fantastic for enterprise consumers. So I think they're still figuring out a bunch of things here as well. Maybe
that's
it's a simple
true. They do have OSS models. All
they
the
do
OSS
have OSS models,
models
not
available.
The proprietary version, right? That's
not
what
the
I was,
proprietary ones,
that's
yeah.
what I was hoping to look for, and I found that yeah. There is no mention of that there.
Yeah, mysteriously not mentioned. So.
And yeah, and this is what led me to make my point, to say that I just think that they're like, hey, they've got enough GPUs for these workloads that we want to run. Let's do a deal and let's just use these GPUs, because that's why they're specifically called out, these agentic workloads. But like I said, I really want to know what those agentic workloads are.
Yeah, it's like we're all looking for this n-dimensional chess, but it's just like we just need more chips. We just need more cloud is maybe the primary driver.
Well, yeah, what are they doing with them? That's what I want to know.
Well, we're always asking the hard questions here on MOE. And that's a great note to end on. So that's all the time that we have for today. Ash, Ambi, Sandy, always great to see you on the show, and hopefully we'll have you on at MOE very soon. And thanks to all you listeners. If you enjoyed what you heard, you can get us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and podcast platforms everywhere. And we'll see you next week on Mixture of Experts.